This is the podcast for Introductory Modern Physics 2710, and the date today is the 24th of April, 2007. Cosmology. Sweet, fun stuff. We won't attempt to do a lot of in-depth math. Know that Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is our best theory of gravitation to date, plays a huge role in this, but there's some other details and other threads of thought that might go on as you talk about cosmology. What's maybe the main fundamental idea, other than, like I say, general relativity, but there's one theme that kind of permeates all discussions of cosmology, that's the study of the history of the universe as a whole. What would that main theme be?
Theme?
What's the fundamental premise of cosmology ever since the 60s? Yeah. Big Bang, is it?
Oh, I was going to say Big Bang, but I was like, no, that can't be right.
Why not?
I don't know. It just...
It's the fundamental theory that explains everything. It's like, it's analogous to the theory of evolution in biology. It's the fundamental premise on which everything is based. In biology, that's what the Big Bang is to cosmology. Obviously, it wasn't always that way. Back in the early days, the 40s and 50s, there was a competing theory called the steady state theory, or the idea that the universe was always about the same. And tell me what it said and how it lost out to the Big Bang theory, Marty Lynn.
Steady state?
Yeah. What are the claims of the steady state?
They see things moving
apart. Okay, from experimental evidence, we see things that are moving farther apart from us. How do we know this? What's the experimental evidence? That's not your question. That's Miles' question. We'll come back to you. How do we know things are moving away from us?
Because we see them moving away from us.
How can you tell they're moving away? You go out and look at the star. Does it get dimmer over time because it's getting further and further away? No?
Let's see. It tells right here. I don't know how they tell. They said they could see galaxies of the universe moving away from each other, but I don't know how.
Okay, Teresa, tell us again.
The redshift,
which is which we learned, you know, about the Doppler effect back when we did waves in the other class a long time ago. We found out that a sound source that's moving away from you, we perceive a lower frequency than is actually being emitted, a lower pitch or tone in sound. In light, that frequency idea corresponds to the color, so objects that are moving away from us are redshifted. It's important to understand that we are not claiming that everything that moves away from us looks red. That's not the issue. When you go out and look at the stars at night and you see some red ones and some orange ones and some yellow ones and some white ones and some blue ones, that's not because they're moving away from us. That's because they're really that color, as we discussed long, long time ago with the black body radiation spectrum curves. They're red because they're cool, or they're blue because they're hot. That's why we have colors of the stars. So we don't mean, when we say that all the galaxies are redshifted, that they look red. You have to understand that what we mean by that is that each wavelength is shifted to a longer wavelength, which means that some of them on the red end of our spectrum are shifted out of the visible range into the infrared, and we don't even see those anymore. But others that were ultraviolet get shifted into the visible. So we still see all the colors. There's still a full range of wavelengths that are coming toward us. It's just that every single individual particular wavelength has been shifted over. So how can you tell that it's redshifted at all? If you look outside the sky at night and you see all of the colors coming from a particular galaxy, why do you think it's redshifted?
Because you know what it's made of, I guess.
And?
You know the spectrums.
You know the lines. You know the spectral lines. Maybe prototypically would be hydrogen. We know where the hydrogen lines are. There's other elements that work too, but hydrogen's the main element in the universe. You know exactly where the hydrogen lines are. So it's not the whole spectrum that all of a sudden looks red, but it's the lines. And we know that the whole spectrum is shifted because the lines are shifted to the red end. In the visible, some are moved a little bit to the red. Some at the very end are moved into the infrared, and others that were invisible on the other end get shifted into the visible on the other end.
How do we know what they're made of?
Yeah, maybe they're just made of something with a similar spectrum.
Yeah.
It's just our hydrogen.
Teresa, you better field that one. Sounds like a serious question.
Well, I think it's true. First, there is this huge assumption that the laws of physics are sort of the same everywhere. So if you see spacing and everything of a hydrogen, it's hydrogen. And it's the reason it shifted is because it's moving away. So laws of physics work. But yeah, I think if you make that assumption, then I guess you know.
I don't know what to believe anymore. I just believe what people tell me to believe. Anybody else want to shape my beliefs? Just say something.
Well, first of all, Teresa's got a great point and a great comment. We do believe the laws of physics are the same everywhere. If we don't, well, I guess it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that that's true. Do they have to be the same everywhere? Well, maybe you can envision a universe where the laws of physics change from place to place. I don't know. Maybe it's logically consistent. But if that's the case, how are we ever going to do any science? If such a universe exists, then they won't be able to do any cosmology or any astrophysics. So we are going on an assumption that the laws of physics are the same everywhere, an assumption that we don't know, but has borne very good fruit. All indications direct us toward the idea that this is true. As to the redshift of the lines, how do we know it's not just some other element? Well, we don't just see this drastically all at once. You can look at some galaxies that are moving away from us very slowly, and their lines are very close to the lines that you see in the spectrum in the laboratory. And other galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster, and their lines are shifted more and more. Now, in the history of this development, it is true that when we discovered quasars, quasi-stellar radio objects, we were baffled at first because we saw lines in the spectrum of quasars that didn't correspond to any element that we knew about. We scratched our heads and looked at the periodic chart and said, maybe the laws of physics aren't the same everywhere, or maybe there are some new elements out there that make these spectral lines that we just aren't recognizing these at all. Part of the reason we didn't recognize them is because we didn't realize how far away those guys were and how fast they're moving away from us. Turned out, somebody finally looked at that and said, they're not in the right place, but I recognize the spacing between the lines. And that pattern is the pattern of hydrogen lines, even though it's not in the right place. And it has been shifted a lot because these quasars are very, very distant and moving very, very fast. And so once they kind of made that connection, then it all fell into place and they realized that it was the hydrogen spectrum, again, not just shifted by a little bit or even a moderate amount, but shifted a whole lot. Do they have any quasars on here? No. But it would be a huge shift on this figure 16.2. So this technique is actually so very accurate. Now, this isn't the main topic of study, so we don't want to get too far afield here, but this will illustrate the idea of redshift and how we can determine how fast and how things are moving with respect to us. This is a picture of a binary star system. Let's zoom in even more. Binary star system. Here's star A going around this blue orbit. Here's star B going around in the black orbit. There's the center of mass between them. Our main goal here is not to talk a lot about binary star systems, but you can see that at this point in time, this is kind of the bird's eye view from the top looking down on the orbits perpendicularly. But if you were to look in the plane, so you're kind of in the plane of this paper, looking along this way toward these stars, you would see star A coming towards you if you looked from over here, if you're on Earth, that's down this way. And you looked at star B, it's moving away from you. And so according to the Doppler effect, the spectrum of this star would be slightly blue shifted because it's coming towards you, to a higher frequency, and star B, which is moving away from you at this point in time, as part of its orbit, would be redshifted. So here's the spectrum that you'd see. It's not true data, it's simulated, but you can see that the lines are split, where the left line in each case of these double lines, the left one corresponds to A, which is to the left on the spectrum, which is toward the blue end. So there's the line for A, and there's the corresponding line for B. There's the line for A, and the corresponding line for B.
Why are there two sets of A's and B's?
Because this element has three spectral lines. In the laboratory, there'd be three lines. Oh. This one, and this one.
Oh, yeah.
But they're split because you get slight shift, blue shift from A and a slight red shift from B. Now, remember, you're kind of in the plane of the paper looking from the Earth toward these, so that's why A is coming towards you and B is moving away from you. But in the next stage, stage two, later in the orbit, as they go around each other, A is now moving perpendicular to your line of sight, which is from this way, and B is moving perpendicular to the line of sight. So in this case, neither one of them has actually shifted at all. And so you see the two lines are not split anymore. They're not separated. They're actually right on top of each other. That's the one spectral line, and both A and B contribute to it. There's the second spectral line, and A and B contribute to it. And there's the third spectral line, and it's not split either. Because neither a star is moving either toward or away from you. Later in its orbit, though, as A moves over to this point right here, it's going to be moving away from you, whereas before it was moving towards you. So we now expect to see, in this stage 3, the lines split again, but the other direction. Now you see line B is on the left, and B is more toward the blue, and A has moved toward the red direction, the red end of the spectrum, due to the relative motions.
And then they again, moving more apart when they go faster, so closer?
Did they try to depict that here? I don't know if they... I think that's a perfectly valid point to make. I don't think this transparency was paying that level of attention to the detail. But in an elliptical orbit, the stars would be going physically faster, higher speed at their perihelion or their point closest to the center of mass. So the velocity, I think they actually do kind of show this a little bit, that this arrow of A pointing away from our line of sight is actually longer than this arrow of A is over here. So I think that they did try to take it into account that much. And technically, what Martin is saying is, if A is moving faster away from us here than it was toward us here, then that should split the lines farther. There should be a wider splitting in this picture. And I don't know that I actually see a wider splitting, but you're right. And this is simulated data. It's not real stuff anyway, but that's true physics. However, they do show down here, you know, how you can figure out what's going on from that idea and look at the radial plot. These is a function of time. So you see this is a periodic function. This is star B, and this is star A's light shifted according to whether it's approaching or receding. So it's blue shifted down here, red shifted up here. This shows the velocity in what, kilometers per second. It's even got numbers on it. But there's a period here, and then it starts over again. So that's the orbital period that it takes for those two stars to go around. And we can get plots like this. So this is actually a technique we've refined fairly well. Just so you'll know how good we are at this Doppler effect, we often use this kind of radar imaging on other planets in our solar system. Send a radar signal to Venus, let it bounce back, and detect a shift in the frequency, just like the police car does when you go speeding down the road. Same type of deal. The microwave radar gun that they use to catch you speeding is what we shine at Venus, and we can detect its speed in orbit. In fact, we're so very, very good at this that if we look at, and I might have a picture of this somewhere in here, but I doubt I'll be able to find it. If we look at the sun very closely and look at the light coming from different parts of the surface of the sphere of the sun, we can actually see certain regions of the sun that are moving toward us and others that are moving away from us, almost as if, you know, it's not a solid, rigid sphere. We talked about its differential rotation yesterday. But parts of it, it's kind of like a big balloon, water balloon that's kind of in modes of oscillation. And you can see parts of the sun that are getting closer to the Earth for a couple of minutes, and then other parts are receding, and they oscillate back and forth. And by the Doppler effect, it's actually fairly easy to see that. So we're very, very good at this technique. We can measure wavelengths or frequencies very, very precisely. It's one of the best, easiest techniques we have, so we're good at it, and it's not hard to measure red shifts or blue shifts. We look at the stars, at the sky. Part of this scheme, part of the history of how we figured all this stuff out, is we first have to know how far away things are, and then we measure their redshift to deduce how fast they're moving. So there are two issues here. How far away are they, and how fast are they moving? And they're related, but you don't come at them from the same techniques. How do you figure out how far away something is? Once you figure the relation between the two, maybe your conclusion is, well, you use that relationship and you say, because of its redshift, you figure out how far away it is. But you only do that for very, very far away galaxies. You don't do that for close things, and we haven't established the relationship yet. So for close things like stars, nearby stars, how do we determine their distances?
Did you say the radar thing?
We can do that with planets in our solar system, but another star would be too far away. That wouldn't work. Any ways to figure out the distance to a star? Close stars, you do what?
Parallax.
What's that?
It's the apparent shift in position from against the background, far background stars.
Okay. Anyway, the idea is if you look at the screen and this is a bullseye, hold your finger up to the screen, arm's length away. Miles, hold up your finger.
I'm sorry.
Marty, then hold up your finger to the bullseye. Okay, close one eye, line it up right there in the middle. Then quickly switch eyes, open the one, close the other.
That used to fascinate me since I was a kid.
Well, you're a budding astronomer, because that's the idea of parallax. You're looking at the finger from two different viewpoints, and it looks like it's in two different positions compared to a very far away thing like this bullseye. So we do the same thing on a much larger scale.
I was like, I'd see people and I'm going to make them move. And I'm like, and I'm like,
the thing that got me was the lines on the paper or the grid line or something. There's something where if you have a blind spot.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
That one was weird. And you didn't see the spot because
These little dots here are the backdrop of very far away stars. This is hard to see, this transparency, but this is the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. And at one point in time, say January, from our line of sight, it looks like this nearby star is in this direction or in this neck of the woods with relation to the backdrop of faraway stars. 6 months later in July, looking at the same nearby star but from our different vantage point, like switching eyeballs, we look from a different angle and the nearby star looks like it's over here with relation to the backdrop of faraway stars. So it appears that the star moves back and forth on a yearly period, nearby stars with respect to faraway stars. And it's not hard to measure that, actually. Well, I should take that back. These angles are very, very small. In theory, conceptually, this is a very straightforward technique to measure the distance to nearby stars. It's pretty simple. You just measure the angle here of this kind of this right triangle. And then since you know this distance, the base of the triangle is the astronomical unit from the sun to the Earth. And if you know this angle, and you know it's a right angle, well, then you can get this distance easily. You can get this side of the triangle very straight. Conceptually, this is super, super simple. In practice, these angles are very small, and to actually physically go out and do this in practice isn't as easy as it sounds because the angles are so tiny. Nonetheless, for 100 or so years, we've been doing this, maybe a couple hundred years, and we can measure this parallax jumping thing for stars that go out to about 100 light years.
So
and we're pretty good at it. Yeah, if you don't get really far away stars, and if some of these are also moving too, then that would complicate your calculations. Notice, though, that on the companion picture here, that if the star is even closer than the nearby star was, if this is even closer still, then your parallax angle is greater, and it looks like it undergoes a much greater change over the seasons of the period of the year. So this cycle is bigger than this one. The idea is the same, but the difference is that this one's closer, so the angle's bigger. That means the side of the triangle is shorter.
I have a question. I don't know that anybody... Did they do that really by taking photos of the sky over time period, then you compare the photos through the telescope? Is that how they measured those angles, really? I mean, at least beginning? I know they did it with some satellite stuff later. Is that how they first actually computed those angles?
They attempted this technique before photography was well developed. So initially, no.
So it was just literally observational?
Yeah, real-time observation. And then checking it again, 6 months later to see if there's a shift. The shift is really, by our standards, very, very small. If you think about the angles here, we're talking about arc seconds. A degree is not a very big unit of angle. And a minute, of course, is 1/60th of that, and a second is 1/60th of that. And that's kind of the level of angular changes that we're talking about. So, like I say, conceptually, this is extremely straightforward. I used to tell my astronomy classes that this is a really easy method, because conceptually it is. And then recently, I read a book. This was last summer. Read a book called Parallax, and it documents the history of how they were able to learn how to measure this. through the 1700s and into the 1800s and stuff. And I came away with a much greater appreciation of the difficulty, the magnitude of the logistical difficulty of actually measuring these tiny, tiny angles. Conceptually, it's a breeze, but practically, it's tough to do.
So when the angle gets too small, is about as far away
The method peters out as you get to slightly further and further away stars, because we just can no longer measure that angle anymore. It's just too small, and we can't tell it's not zero.
What's the range with that?
100 light years.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Of course, that depends on us knowing the distance from the sun to the Earth is called the astronomical unit.
How do we figure that out?
But if you had a bigger baseline, then you could do better. So the next trick would be to send up a satellite into orbit, say, around the sun, but at the distance of Jupiter, which is 5 AUs away, have a 5 times as wide baseline. Even if you could only measure the same angles, you could still measure out to 5 times the distance. Since that's in 3 space, 5 cubed, you'd be able to measure the parallax of 125 times as many stars if you could get a baseline 5 times as big.
Well, that sounds like it would be an interesting book. I mean...
Oh, I highly recommend it.
Really doing observation, they'd have to know the sky really well. I mean, just to pick a star, you need to notice which ones look like they were shifting.
That's exactly right. You have to figure out which ones have the greatest parallax that you can hope to measure. Out of all the 2,000 or 3,000 stars that you can see with your naked eye, of course, they did have telescopes, so you can probably see 10,000 stars with a good telescope. Which of those is going to be most likely to exhibit parallax? You actually have to look through, you know, check over a year's period every single one of those stars. Well, you hope to focus your efforts on the ones that are going to have the greatest parallax. That means the closer stars. It's a fascinating book. If you're into reading science books, I recommend it. I can't remember the author's name right off the top of my head, but it's called simply Parallax. It was very enjoyable, very easy reading, not extremely lengthy, like almost no math in it. It's for the lay people, but it's a science history book, you know, and it's just very, very interesting. If you like that kind of stuff, you ought to put it on your summer reading list. It's in the same genre. It reminds me a lot of another book I read a couple years before that was called The Measure of Man or something like that, which was a history of how they measured the meter, how they figured out how long a meter was back during the French Revolution in the 1790s, how they tried to triangulate and survey a distance from the equator to the North Pole that went through Paris. It's also a fascinating history of science book. And the style of writing kind of reminded me of, you know, the two books were a little bit similar in that regard. Different physics problems, but kind of similar type books. So I recommend both of them if you like that kind of reading. If you're interested in that stuff, I could look them up and give you some more specific details. But the point is that we can, in fact, find the distance to nearby stars. That's great, but what happens if you want to know the distances to further away things, say more than 100 light years? What are you going to do? Teresa, you seem to be an expert on astronomy. You probably know this. How do you measure the distances to farther things, like the other side of our galaxy?
Well, I think what they did is they took all those, the ones that they actually could do the, knew the distances and figured out the brightnesses and everything and mapped it on the HR diagram. And then you use that to extend out, the, when you looked at where the stars fit on that, you could know how bright they really were, then you could figure out their distances.
HR diagrams would be very important. There's one other little technique in the middle there called Cepheid variables. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
What do they do?
They're variable stars, and their rate of variation is directly related to their brightness.
What do you mean by a variable star? I'm asking the questions that Marty Lynn and Miles should be asking, but they're not doing it, so I am. What's a variable star?
Keep going.
Well, it's one
that's
not quite in balance, so it gets bigger and brighter, and cools down and contracts and gets dimmer, and it depending on the actual size of the star, they have a set rate, and it's related to the real brightness of it.
So you mean if I go out in if I go out to observe at night and look at the same star over and over and over again, sometimes it will be brighter and sometimes it will be dimmer. Is that what you're saying? See, you're supposed to be asking this, Miles.
Like one that's easy to see is Algol or whatever. You can see that one.
Okay. That's exactly right. What's the period of this variation? Is it minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years?
Well, the ones I've looked at, they're days, because then you can see them. But it varies all across. I mean, some of them actually are like hours. Not that many hours. A lot of them are days. Some of them are weeks. There's some of them, I don't know if it's the CFID, which ones, but some of them are like a couple of months that they pay attention to.
In general, days. You could probably have some outliers, but over a period of 3 or 4 days, you could noticeably, even to your naked eye, see a dimming in some stars and then a brightening again, and the period can be a few days. But Teresa's point is that that period isn't the same for all of the stars, and it's directly related to their intrinsic brightness. Now, yes, they vary, but some vary down here, and others vary brighter, you know, they're brighter to begin with. So their period, the time it takes for them to repeat over and over again, is directly related to their intrinsic brightness. If you can get a handle on the intrinsic brightness, and then you can kind of see how bright it looks, this is called apparent brightness versus absolute brightness, you can just assume an inverse square relationship, because the light spreads out in all directions, and you can calculate a distance if you know the apparent brightness and if you know the true absolute brightness. So the luminosity variation period of Cepheid variable stars tells you their absolute brightness. You look how bright they appear, and you can deduce their distance. That works for farther away than the parallax method. But we'd be totally stuck between the two methods, except that they overlap. There are some stars that are Cepheid variables that are within 100 light years. So we can measure their parallax, and that helps us to first even understand what the relationship is between the period of variation and their absolute brightness. It helps us draw the graph in the first place, is that there's some we know the distance to from parallax. So the methods have to kind of overlap so that you can calibrate the next method. Cepheid variables is a great method that works clear out to millions of light years. In fact, the Andromeda galaxy, which you can see with the naked eye, but it's a whole other galaxy just like our Milky Way with a couple hundred million stars in it, has some Cepheid variables in those couple hundred million stars that we can see individually with our telescopes. We can see individual stars. We can see the period of variation, individual Cepheid variable stars. And so we can then deduce the distance from here to the Andromeda galaxy. And that's how we know that it's 2 million light years away. The light that we see tonight from the Andromeda galaxy left there 2 million years ago.
The farther away stars, are they moving faster necessarily?
We're getting to that. In fact, let's go to that now. There are other methods of distance determination, but they're less important and they're not the main point of the discussion. But at some point, we have to say, okay, we know how to determine distances, and then we finally note that there's a relationship between, I wouldn't say individual stars, which was your question, but galaxies. Mm-hmm. Galaxies, yes. What we notice in general, kind of as an average, is that the further away a galaxy is, and we know how to figure those out, then the redshift tells us that it's moving faster. There's a direct relationship between the distance to a galaxy and how fast it's moving away. Are there any blue-shifted galaxies? No. With a couple of minor, insignificant exceptions in our local group that happen to be drifting toward us because they're gravitationally part of our group, but they don't count, and I'm not going to mention them anymore. So just know there's a couple of examples that are slightly blue-shifted. Out of thousands and thousands, well, out of billions of galaxies, there's two that are blue-shifted. So I'm going to ignore those from now on. All the galaxies are red-shifted, and the farther away they are, the more red-shifted they are, which means they're moving faster.
Because I was thinking about the stars in the galaxies, so that means their speed going around their orbits and stuff are insignificant compared to their going away speed.
We can actually measure both things. Yeah. Just like we did with that binary star system with the two stars going around each other and seeing it shift, we can actually see stars on a big spiral galaxy that are going toward us or away from us that the light has shifted blue or red, relatively speaking, from that rotational motion. But if the overall thing is moving away faster than that, then all the light would still be red shifted anyway. But maybe less if it's got some component coming toward us. But we can measure all that and decompose that and figure out what contributions are. But the Hubble law, that's worth writing down, expresses...
Mine says it's perfect.
there's a direct relationship between the recessional speed and the distance. And the constant of proportionality, whether I have this right or backwards, is called the Hubble constant, named after Edwin Hubble, who realized that all these galaxies were moving away from us, and then deduced that this must mean that the universe is expanding. Now, how does this fit back into Einstein that we started our discussion with? He came up with the law, the theory of general relativity, which is our best theory of gravitation, and he realized that the equations say that you can't have a static universe. That is, the equations claim that the universe is either contracting or expanding. But when did he come up with this? In the 19-teens. Right? Remember this? 1915, 1916?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we didn't know the universe was expanding. He thought it was static. So he went back to the equations and jury-rigged them. Fixed them up. The original general relativity equations say the universe is contracting or expanding, and he didn't like that. So he threw in an extra term called the cosmological constant that allowed for a static universe. There's the cosmological constant. He threw the lambda into his general relativity to allow for what he thought was a static universe, neither expanding nor contracting. 10 years later, in the 20s, was when Hubble did his work and saw the redshift of all the different galaxies and realized this relationship that I just erased, namely that the farther away they are, the faster they're moving. And he said, you know what? The data says we do live in an expanding universe. So Einstein had to go back and remove the cosmological constant that he had thrown in. He called this the biggest blunder of his career, was this cosmological constant. Didn't need it, because the universe really is expanding, contrary to what he first thought.
I bet you would feel pretty foolish after doing that.
Wouldn't you feel dumb if you were Einstein?
But I feel smart at the same time. I guess I was right.
So the universe is expanding. What does that even mean? Yes, Teresa?
Are they still talking about a cosmological constant, though? I mean, just when we read this chapter,
you guys are always ahead of me. You steal all my surprises. I was going to hide that till the end of the discussion. The cosmological constant will come back. You ruined it, Teresa.
You're creeping down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, I wanted you to think the cosmological constant was gone. The universe is expanding. What's the correct line of reasoning here? If the universe is expanding, what does that mean to say that it's expanding? What's expanding? Well, we know the galaxies are moving away from us. Are we then claiming that the galaxies are moving through pre-existing space farther away from us, and that someday will they reach the edge of the universe?
Sure. No, it's like a big balloon. See, you're blowing up the balloon, and it's going to pop eventually.
What's the balloon?
The universe.
Space-time? Einstein space-time?
Well, that's what I meant.
This is the startling thing that I think is really tough for most people to get over the first time they hear this. You might just have to let this statement just kind of wash over your neurons and then just bathe your neurons with this thought for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it will become comfortable, and maybe you'll reconcile yourself to this thought. This is very difficult to comprehend. It's not hard to say. It's not even hard to understand what I'm saying, but to really grasp it and believe it and get your brain around it might take a couple of weeks. We are not claiming that the galaxies are moving away from us through pre-existing space. We are claiming that the space-time itself is what's expanding, dragging the galaxies along with it. And in fact, to further drive this point home, we actually, this is kind of a minor point, but just to pound on the previous point, we don't even call it a Doppler shift when we talk about this cosmological redshift, because the Doppler shift refers to sources of waves that are moving away from you through space. And these sources, these galaxies, are not moving away from us through space. The space is stretching, and that is why the waves get stretched into a longer wavelength. It's not just due to the motion, the recessional motion of the galaxies through space like we talked about back in waves when we did sound waves and the Doppler effect then. It's actually not a Doppler redshift. It's a cosmological redshift where the waves, which may have started out as yellow waves, as they go through space, which is stretching, it stretches the waves out to a longer wavelength, which is redder. It's a cosmological redshift rather than a Doppler redshift. It's not the galaxies moving through space. It's the space expanding, dragging the galaxies along with it. And that's why everybody uses the balloon analogy, where the balloon, the rubber of the balloon, represents the space-time. Of course, we're two dimensions short, because the rubber of the balloon is a two-dimensional surface, and we need four. We need X, Y, Z, and T. It's the time. It's also, you know, it's one of the dimensions that's getting expanded. So it's difficult to do that in four dimensions, so the analogy is imperfect. But it really actually, if you consider that and understand that and realize you're two dimensions short, other than that, it's a pretty decent analogy. Blow up a balloon, think of the rubber as the space-time, glue pennies onto the rubber balloon, and as you blow up the balloon, the pennies get farther and farther apart. And if you put yourself on any one of the pennies, remember you can't see through the interior of the balloon. That's not part of your space. You're only a two-dimensional creature. You only know about the 2D curved surface itself. So as you look through the rubber, in the rubber, across to other galaxies, other pennies, you would see them moving away from you. And you would see the farther away they are, the faster they're going.
And that's why there's no centers, because it just... That's weird. I was thinking about the balloon as three space.
No, no, it's two space. You don't get to go through the middle. And my point is that it's the old Copernican principle that the Earth is not special. Any place you put yourself on this balloon, any one of those pennies you happen to pick, you would observe the same thing. You would look at nearby pennies, and they would be moving away from you, but slightly further away pennies would be moving away from you faster, and further away pennies would be moving faster still. Anybody on any penny would all measure the same Hubble relationship, that the farther away they are, the faster they're going. And everybody would say that. And so nobody's special. Our galaxy's not special. The fact that we say, everything's moving away from us, we must be the center. Or even more strongly, everything's moving away from us, and the further away they are, the faster they're going, therefore we're the center. Everybody would observe the same thing. Now, why do we use pennies when in the old days we used to just paint dots onto the balloon? Because if you draw dots onto your rubber, as the rubber expands, the dots expand too. And that's just a slight misleading thing. That's why I like the pennies better. The galaxies themselves do not expand because they are gravitationally bound systems. The atoms aren't actually getting physically larger. They're bound by electromagnetism. So bound systems can overcome the stretching of the space. You know, the gravity is stronger than the stretching of the space. So the galaxy isn't getting bigger because gravity holds stuff in. But the space between galaxies, and technically the space in the galaxy, is stretching and getting bigger. So I like the pennies because the pennies don't get bigger as you blow up the balloon, but the distance between pennies gets bigger as the balloon blows up. Of course, the balloon can't have a little air pole to blow into. It's just got to expand with total symmetry, you know, total sphere. But if you know those limitations of the model, it actually explains things fairly well. Remember, you're two dimensions shy of truth. Did you have a question, Teresa?
Mm-hmm. No, but actually, yeah. That explains there. I was talking about the cosmic background radiation. That makes more sense to think of it, that it's just since it's expanding, that's why it's
stretching.
Out to
Let's talk about that.
I'm saying that's left over from the hot Big Bang, the background radiation. It's just so low.
Switch back to the
small or big or whatever you call it, because it's so stretched.
Right. Let's go there. This is just simply a diagram of the Hubble relationship. showing that the distance is directly related to the recessional velocity. It's a linear relationship there, and that's the data that proves that. So that's the Hubble law, that the velocity is directly proportional to the distance. But everybody on each penny would also have data very similar to this, and they would all try to claim that they're at the center until they realize that everybody's at the center, or that nobody's at the center. There is no center. Ken, here's another picture of the same thing from an animated perspective. Again, the transparency is not very beautiful, but it's too dark. But there's five galaxies there, A, B, C, D on one row and E on the next row. And as they expand and move apart, you can measure the distances. You know, if you're at A, then B's moving away from you, and C's moving away from you faster, and D's moving away from you faster. You can actually see that that would be the case here by doing the numbers. But the funny thing is that even if you didn't pick A, if you picked C or E or anything, no matter which one you pick, that would all, you'd get the same result. That is, that the further away they are, the faster they're moving. Well, what we want to then jump to is from Hubble's idea that the universe is expanding, what's the logical consequence of that? Well, you want to run the movie backwards. You want to flip on the reverse switch and say, if everything's rushing away from everything else now, what was the case in prior times, long time ago? Was the universe smaller? And maybe was it really small? And the answer is, yeah, we think so. And that's the origin of the Big Bang Theory. Contrast that to the old theory. Remember we said there was another competing theory way back when called the steady state theory that Marty Lynn told us about. The steady state people agreed that the data says that the universe is, that the galaxies are moving away from us. But the way they justified that is they claimed that, and they actually violated conservation of matter here, but it didn't bother them because they didn't violate it very badly, that new protons and new electrons and whatever we needed, new neutrons, were being created out of nothing as these other galaxies moved away from us, so that the overall average density of the universe was constant over time. Now, you'd only have to create, you know, one proton every cubic meter every year or so. You don't have to create a lot of matter here. Just one proton every cubic meter every year to keep up the total amount of density as things get further and further away. You know, otherwise, you'd think it would just get thinner and thinner and thinner, less dense as it gets away. But you create new matter, and it forms into new galaxies and new stars, and you keep everything the same. That's the steady-state model. It's the competitor to the Big Bang model. They both agree that galaxies are moving away from us, but they disagree on what happened in the past and what's going to happen in the future. Big Bang model says we run the movie backwards, and if everything's rushing away, we're not going to violate conservation of energy, but we're just going to say that in the past, things all had to be close together in some small little volume, and not just the matter, but in fact, the space and time itself, the universe, not just the matter in the universe, but the universe was a small thing, and it was hot, like 10 to the 30th Kelvins. And for some reason, it decided to expand. Who knows why? Although the Elegant Universe addressed this. When the banging brains, do you remember that?
A couple times.
Yeah. But if you don't talk about string theory, then we don't know why it decided to expand. But all of a sudden, it starts to explode. And it's not galaxies moving through space. It's space expanding, pulling the galaxies along with it. Teresa mentions the cosmic microwave background radiation. She's mentioned it a couple of times today. Let's show you what this looks like. That, my friends, is a classic black body radiation curve. And you've seen many, many of these back in Chapter 1 when we first talked about black bodies. That is a black body radiation curve. And we know that by the shape of the curve, we can figure out the temperature of the object. This is the black body radiation curve from the universe. We shine our infrared telescopes out into the sky. Actually, we have to launch them above the atmosphere and get away from the heat sources. And we map out the over wavelength. You look at all these different wavelengths. But this is infrared and longer wavelengths, even more than infrared. These are microwave waves that have wavelengths of 2 to 4 to 6 millimeters. Those are microwaves. And you say, that's interesting. Where are all these microwaves coming from? Well, the Big Bang has an explanation for this. In fact, the Big Bang demands this. The Big Bang would not stand up if it weren't for this. The Big Bang depends on this, and if this weren't there, the Big Bang would be wrong. This is a key piece of supporting evidence for the Big Bang, and it's basically the reason why the steady state theory died and is no longer considered a worthy competitor. It's just nobody believes it anymore. Everybody's on the Big Bang bandwagon now, and this is basically why. This is real data. This is genuine, real data. And it matches perfectly. The line drawn through there is the theoretical curve for a black body that has a temperature of just under 3 Kelvin. Now, that's cold. That's colder than liquid helium. It's 2.7 Kelvin. And it matches it perfectly. So we say, huh, the universe is a black body with a temperature, a black body temperature of 2.7 Kelvin.
How do we know the temperature of the universe?
We measured the microwave spectrum. That's how we know the temperature of the universe. That, the shape and distribution of that curve is the shape and distribution of a curve that's at 2.7 Kelvin. Use Planck's black body formula from chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
Plug in 2.7 for T. That's the curve you get. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
However,
if you went and measured it a billion years from now, would it be lower, though?
Absolutely. Yeah, the universe is still expanding, so we don't expect this curve to stay the same over eons and eons. Over lifetime of man, yes, this would be the same, but over billions of years, the universe would expand more. And the point is, well, let's go back and say that if you believe in the Big Bang, if it's expanding now, then in the past it was small and dense and hot. The Big Bang, if you were to measure this curve 15 billion years old, 14 billion years ago, then you wouldn't get a curve like this. You'd get a curve of something that's 10 to the 30th Kelvins instead of 3 Kelvins. So the universe is cooling, because things that expand cool. In your thermodynamics class, you learn that when gases expand, they cool. Well, that's exactly what's going on here, only it's more of this stretching space-time that's pulling out these waves. If you had super hot 10 to the 30th Kelvin universe 13 billion years ago, where the photons that were zipping around were extremely short wavelength, extremely high frequency, extremely energetic photons, over 13 billion years of stretching the space-time, those wavelengths would have been stretched out from super, super short wavelengths, gamma rays, into microwaves. And so you can run the numbers on that. You can do the calculations, do the math, figure out how hot the universe was when it started, how long it's been stretching and cooling, 13.7 billion years, and then that it should now be 2.7 Kelvins. And that exactly matches the data that we see. This all fits together totally and completely. It is the number one key, strongest piece of evidence for the Big Bang. And in fact, this is the data and the theory and, well, the measurement of it that won the Nobel Prize for 2006 in physics. And I have given that talk twice here on campus this semester about the Nobel Prize in physics. It was given for the people who measured this curve. That's the data they took for the universe. Notice it's not all uniform, so that's our next question, is why isn't it all uniform? Slightly hotter in some regions and slightly cooler in others, but the average is 2.7 Kelvin. Teresa's point then is, if the universe has cooled off for the past billions of years from 10 to the 30th Kelvin down to 3 Kelvin, would the curve change shape again in the future or more continually? And the answer is yes. As it cools even cooler and cooler and cooler, the wavelengths of the photons zipping around the universe would get longer and longer and longer, stretched to a longer wavelength, which corresponds to a black body curve of a cooler object. The answer is yes. Before we talk about the variations in this drawing, let's just say that there is one other key piece of evidence for the Big Bang theory. This is the main piece, but a secondary line of evidence. Secondary line of evidence is that the Big Bang makes solid predictions about the relative ratios of the elements, hydrogen and helium. The steady state has no match for this. There's no corresponding prediction in the steady state theory. But the Big Bang, just only a priori, you just look at the assumptions and the starting conditions and just run the numbers. The Big Bang says that the universe should be made up of about 75% hydrogen and 25% helium and only tiny, tiny, tiny trace amounts of anything above that. So the periodic chart in a high school classroom 13 billion years ago would have been fairly simple. Would have only had two elements on it. And what do you see when you look out in the sky and you look at the skies and the stars and see what they're made of, 75% hydrogen and 25% helium, exactly what the Big Bang Theory predicts. So the relative abundance of elements is another strong piece of evidence for the Big Bang Theory. Nearly every cosmologist that you find will tell you that the Big Bang Theory is fundamental to the study of the universe as a whole and cosmology. And there are only a few fringe crackpot people that would still deny it. Now, that's not to say you can't entertain other ideas. I believe in being open-minded and listening to other people and various viewpoints. That's all well and dandy, and I support that. But frankly, the evidence is very, very strong for the Big Bang. And most of the people who oppose it are crackpots. Maybe not every one of them, but most of them are weird crackpots. It's fundamental to the discipline as evolution is to biology. It's the fundamental principle on which everything's based. We want the universe to have a uniform temperature because it was all the same temperature at one time, 13, 14 billion years ago. So when it expands, we still expect it to have kind of the same temperature all over. And indeed, whether you look in any part of the sky, you get that same spectrum, that same black body radiation curve that says the universe is 2.7 Kelvin. No matter which direction you look, it's isotropic. Look, you know, north or west or any direction you want to, and plot out that curve over various wavelengths, you get the same 2.7 Kelvin black body radiation curve. That's well and good. That's what we want. That's what we expect. At that level, at that number of significant digits, at that precision. However, if you talk about millikelvin, you don't want the universe to be exactly uniform. You want there to be slightly hotter spots and slightly cooler spots. This is a picture, a remnant, a leftover of the structure of the very, very early universe. And if the universe were totally, totally, totally uniform, so completely uniform in the early universe, even at the millikelvin scale, then it would have expanded out uniformly and would not have permitted for any clumping of matter into galaxies and stars and clusters of galaxies. And so if this curve, if the data that we had taken with this satellite that won the Nobel Prize last year, if it had shown not only a 2.7 Kelvin curve in every direction, but a 2.700000000 curve, or it didn't even matter if they're zeros, but if it's the same in all directions, we would have really been worried, because then we would not have an explanation for galaxies. We know the universe is clumpy today. You know about galaxies, but even larger structures, galaxies tend to congregate together as well into large clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies, and it looks like, as you map out the locations of galaxies in the nighttime sky, that there are huge voids, bubbles that are empty and have almost no stars or galaxies in them, and then the soap film around the bubble tends to have all the galaxies. And you see, you know, cells like that all over the universe, you know, bubbles of nothing inside, but on the surface, the soap film, so to speak, is where galaxies tend to congregate. We see clumpiness in our universe, and there has to be an explanation for it. If you run the clock backwards, the early universe can't have been perfectly uniform, or there'd be no explanation for where the clumpiness that we observe today came from. So, while what I told you is true, it's 2.7 in every direction you look, it's not exactly down to the millikelvin scale the same in every direction. And this picture shows, or even down to the microkelvin scale, this picture shows slight differences, which explains how the universe became clumpy. Any comments? This is further evidence. I mean, this is what won the Nobel Prize last year.
That's just a picture like this big, right?
Okay. This is a picture of the whole universe.
The whole universe.
The equator goes along here, and the North Pole and the South Pole.
Out looking in. But you can't picture it like that, can you?
You've seen pictures of the Earth like this, that shows the whole Earth.
Oh, so
this is the same thing, only we're looking from the inside out. You can think of latitude and longitude on the sky. They call them declination and right ascension in astronomy instead of latitude and longitude. But you can think of similar coordinates to map out anywhere on your celestial sphere, and then you could fold that out into a projection like this. So this is a map of the whole universe. You don't look happy.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we?
I'm just trying to picture Because isn't it 3D
deep?
So this has a filling then.
This doesn't show the depth of the universe. The ancients didn't know how far away things were, and they thought there was this celestial sphere surrounding the Earth where all the stars were tacked on to this globe that surrounded us.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously false. We know things are closer and further away. However, it's still a useful model, like the Bohr model of the atom. If you ignore the depth direction, the dimension of depth or distance away from us, just paint everything on a two-dimensional sphere around us,
oh,
that's what this is a
okay.
picture of.
I see.
You look happier. Comments, Teresa? Correct me if I say anything wrong, will you?
Inside.
We're not in the rainbow.
Yeah,
about
we are.
Is that the data from the satellite they put way out in
like
the second Lagrange point or whatever
on one of the sites
to get there?
From
I'm not sure which one they put out there. This is the data from Kobe.
Maybe I got
the
well, I don't know. I'm confused.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Because don't they have another satellite that's refining Kobe data?
Yes, at a much higher resolution than this. That's called WMAP, the Wilson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. That may be at the Lagrange point, I don't know. But that's just recent stuff. And it takes them a long time for the Nobel Prize Committee to determine that a particular contribution to science is worthy of a Nobel Prize. You can't get the Nobel Prize when you're dead, but you also don't get it the year after your discovery. So this was done in the early 90s, 91, 92, and they just got the Nobel Prize for it last year. They have since sent up another satellite that has increased the resolution on this picture many fold, so you get a more finely detailed picture of this stuff now. Is that what you were thinking of?
Yeah, it's the Delhi thing you were talking about. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Okay.
That's the Kobe one. Okay.
Yep.
The Big Bang says the universe is expanding. Space-time is expanding, dragging the galaxies along with it. What do we expect the future to bring? If the universe is expanding, and yet all of the galaxies are gravitationally pulling on all of the other galaxies, lots of mass lying around in our universe. You know, our Earth weighs a lot. The Sun weighs many, 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 many times that. And then there's, of course, 100 billion suns in our galaxy. And then there's 100 billion galaxies, so there's a lot of mass lying around, each particle pulling on every other particle mutually through either Newton's law of gravitation. If it's not too strong, you could use that calculation. Or you could do Einstein's general relativity with the bent space idea. Either way, there's this gravitational force that's pulling everything together. So you would certainly expect, as does everyone, you know, that's thought about this, concluded that the expansion of the universe must be slowing down. Because, yeah, there's this initial explosion that blew everything out, but then now there's this continuous attraction between every two massive bodies, and so it must be slowing down. And in fact, for half of my teaching career, I taught that, as did every other physics and astronomy teacher in the universe. We taught that the expansion of the universe is slowing down. It had to be. It just simply had to be. But it's not. It's speeding up. This is almost a 10-year-old discovery now. In 1998, we learned that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And it totally, totally took us by surprise and completely floored us. Changed every textbook. And I would be willing to bet quite a bit of money we'll eventually get somebody a Nobel Prize. I mean, it completely changed what we thought and taught about cosmology. The question before 1998 was, is it slowing down enough to close the universe? That is to say, to stop the expansion and maybe even make it contract, which might end up as it rushes back together in a big crunch or a Gnab Gib. That's Big Bang backwards. And some people felt that that was more philosophically appealing. Some people thought it was somehow nicer to our egos, I guess, to think of, even though this big crunch or Gnab Gib would crush us out of existence, that maybe it could then spark a new Big Bang and maybe life could start all over again. And that seemed to some people to be a little bit more satisfying than the alternative. If there's not enough mass in the universe to slow down the expansion enough, well, then, by golly, it might just expand out forever, and get thinner and thinner and thinner, and the universe would end not with a bang, but a whimper. I don't know what you like better. That neither of them is going to preserve your grandkids. But that was the debate. Before 1998, we were trying very diligently to measure the expansion rate of the universe to find out if it would ever stop, or if it was just asymptotically slowing, or if you're going to exactly what the state was. We have different shapes of the universe based on this. The shape of your space, which is now non-Euclidean, would determine your geometry. Did we talk about the angles of a triangle and a sphere adding up to more than 180 degrees? Maybe in our universe, if it's shaped like this, if the space-time, in 4D, I must stress, is if it's shaped like this in a spherical sort of shape, maybe the angles of a triangle really do add up to more than 180 degrees. We wouldn't notice that on a local earthly level. I mean, you could see it on the surface of a sphere like the Earth, with latitude and longitude lines. But truly, if you tried to draw an angle on your triangle on your paper, maybe if you lived in a space like this and you drew a really big triangle, it would be different than 180. And parallel lines in this universe come together. These beams are parallel, but they converge. That was in one of the videos I showed you too, right? The general relativity one. Or do we live in a flat space where they do add up to 180, everything's Euclidean, and it's just like we thought, and parallel beams just stay parallel and never meet? Or do we live in a saddle-shaped universe which has negative curvature, also called hyperbolic space, where the angles of a triangle add up to less than 180 degrees, and if you shine two parallel beams in this space, they actually diverge away from each other? Which of these do we live in? That was the debate before 1998. In fact, the data shows that our universe is fairly close to flat, and so it wasn't an easy question to answer because it was so close to flat that we didn't know if it was flat or just close to flat. So like I say, 1998 was a revolutionary year. I, along with everyone else, had to change what they taught their astronomy classes. This is kind of the final state of things as it ended up now. Oh, this is too hard to see. If I zoom out enough so you can see the whole picture, then you can't read it. So this is kind of a hard graph to understand, but I'll kind of explain it, and then we'll zoom in a little bit. This is the matter density across the bottom, and this is, well, we better talk about this thing right here. If the universe is not merely expanding, but in fact accelerating, expanding out faster and faster and faster, something's pushing it. That was a big surprise in 1998. We just thought that the matter was pulling on everything, slowing it down. And now we find out that's not the case, or that is to say, yeah, gravity's still true, matter's still pulling on each other, but there's something else that's pushing it away faster than it's being pulled. And the expansion is, in fact, accelerating. And so what do we claim that is doing that? What's the cause of that? We have no idea, frankly. I mean, that's the big question in cosmology today, is what is it that's causing the accelerating expansion of the universe that we found out about in 1998? And because we don't have any idea what it is, we call it dark. And to distinguish it from dark matter, which was a separate issue, let's just take a one-minute side detour here. In a totally separate discussion, it turns out that stars go around the center of their galaxy at certain rates, and if we know Kepler's laws and the laws of Newtonian physics, we should be able to calculate how fast the stars go around. Well, they go around faster than they're supposed to, some of them. And so we have to say, there's more matter there than we can see. There must be some dark matter that's invisible, that's making the rotation curve what it is. So a few years before this issue, we already had invented this idea of dark matter that gravitates. That is to say, it's massive and causes gravitation. Do we know what dark matter is? No, we still don't. We're very sure it's out there. We're very sure that we only see a small fraction of the matter that's out there. We know it's there because of gravitation, but we can't see it. It apparently doesn't shine, and so we call it dark matter. But that was a separate issue. That's a galactic thing, and we already knew about that before this. So when we found this stuff, we said, we don't know what it is, so we'll call it dark, but we can't call it dark matter because we already talked about dark matter for this other issue. This apparently may not even be a matter kind of thing at all. There's some kind of dark energy that is pushing the universe apart, almost in a sense kind of a anti-gravity type thing that's pushing out. And in fact, this is where
Einstein's cosmological constant, the biggest blunder of his career, actually returns. And you plug that lambda back in the equations to account for the fact that this is accelerating now rather than slowing down. So Einstein was right all along, even when he thought he made the biggest blunder of his life. So dark energy, if you figure out what it is, you get the Nobel Prize. Matter density and dark energy density.
That helps symmetry, doesn't it? Because, I don't know, just when you're doing electrostatic stuff, you have positive and negative. And that's kind of what you want to have, is a positive gravity and then maybe a...
I'll say maybe. And I don't really necessarily understand this stuff enough to be very authoritative about it. It's very new, and I haven't studied it a lot. It's not exactly a negative term in gravity. It's not like an anti-gravity. It's a different kind of energy pressure that's pushing things out. So I see your point, but I'm not sure I'd go so far as to claim that it's specifically an anti-gravity that balances symmetrically the attractive gravity. Something else. It's an energy pressure that's pushing things out. Anyway, look at this data here. The blue vertical bar is the data. Well, let's not go to the blue vertical bar. Let's go to this red stuff. This is the information we get from the cosmic microwave background radiation that I just showed you, the COBE data that verifies the Big Bang. Its data on this funny graph, remember the axes are a little bit bizarre. This is the matter density of the universe. This is the dark energy, and you may not even understand what a graph of one versus the other even means. But nonetheless, this kind of orangish swath through here, orange-red thing, is the range of possible parameters for a universe based on the data we got from that cosmic microwave background radiation. And this is what we used to think. We used to think that the energy density parameter was exactly 1. That's right here. And we used to think that the dark energy parameter lambda, that's omega sub lambda, was exactly 0. So there are the two coordinates that we used to think. This is before 1998. And the question was, you know, how close to this blue line are we? Is the universe closed or is the universe open? Which side do we fall on? It was hard to find out. Because right along this line is the flat universe, the Euclidean universe, where parallel lines stay parallel. And we couldn't quite decide if we were exactly on the line or just barely to one side of it. This is kind of the range of data that we used to be looking at before 1998. We didn't know if it would expand forever or recollapse. You know, that was kind of the question. Well, since then, we came up with this other kind of data. The blue range of data from galaxy clusters provides this information here, and says that our universe, based on these two parameters, the dark energy density and the matter density, those two parameters have to be in this range here. It has to be between here and here, and then it can be anywhere on this axis. But already, if we know the universe has to be inside this blue data, that already eliminates what we used to think. This old model is not consistent with the new data. And furthermore, besides the blue data, this is the one that really kicked us in 1998. From type 1 supernovae, stars that blow up, we measured them in a certain way, and that's the range given by the white curve, data on the curve here. So the true universe has to be in the region of overlap of all these. It has to be in the background data, has to be in the galaxy cluster data, and it has to be in the supernova data. And so that doesn't leave you very many options. That means you have to be in this region right here. So the current model is right here, which tells you that the expansion is speeding up. So this is quite new, but that's the current understanding of the universe right now, and they're trying to figure out what the heck this is. If you do a Google search for dark energy, you'll read lots of interesting articles, but basically they'll tell you they have no idea what it is. Maybe the disconcerting thing maybe we should end with is that what all of this means is the stuff that we know and love, protons, neutrons, and electrons that make up the hydrogen that fuses in our sun and warms us on our planet that's made of oxygen, silicon, and carbon, that's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the universe. Most of the universe is made of dark matter and dark energy.
Well, it's been fun, except I talked way too much. You should have asked more questions.
It almost makes you wonder if people weren't taught
give me a for instance, like maybe if Einstein never invented general relativity, then we wouldn't have come up with the Big Bang. And
no, like maybe someone might think of it, but they've been polluted by other ideas, so they just don't know how to think.
So are you saying that maybe another civilization on another similar planet might have a different explanation for the universe than we do?
Well, yeah, but that's kind of obvious, I guess. But this is kind of what we're
doing. Is it obvious? I mean, if there is, if the universe really is physically one way, and if our science and their science continually gets better and better and better, won't our successive theories converge to the same spot?
I think so, but I'm just saying they probably have a different theory and know different things that we don't.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they have different data, yeah, right. But you agree they'd converge. Concluding thoughts, Miles?
I don't know. I say there's no reason to not keep in mind that we could be way off.
That's certainly true, and I think scientists need to be humble enough to maintain a strong sense of our ignorance. I agree with that really thoroughly. I truly, truly do. But I have to tell you that the evidence we have for the Big Bang is quite compelling, and I'm not saying you're doubting the Big Bang per se, but some people do. I mean, you know, some might come at it from a religious standpoint and have every bit as much of an objection on religious grounds to the Big Bang that they might in biology to evolution. And to them, I'd say, well, you know, whatever your faith is, that's fine, and science doesn't tell you about the supernatural. It's not its job or its goal. And there may be other truths out there, but as far as we can determine from science and the methods of science and determining nature's laws in the natural world, not the supernatural world, the evidence for this is actually really quite strong. Do scientists argue about the details? Yes. But do they argue about whether there was a Big Bang? Not really. When I was your age, I used to ask heretical questions that my professors would pat me on the head and, you know, go away, little boy, you can't ask questions like that, they're not science. Questions like, you know, what happened before the Big Bang, or what caused the Big Bang, or things like that. I think they mentioned this in string theory. When I was your age, those were considered to be outside the realm of science because they're not testable, and that's the definition of science, it's testable. And so they'd say, you know, go ask that in a philosophy class or a religious environment. We can't answer that in science. But I've been very, very intrigued that over the past 20 or 30 years, some of the questions that I was told are not scientific questions now have gained some kind of respectability in scientific circles, and they are asking those kinds of questions. What caused the Big Bang, or how did it come about, or what happened before the Big Bang? That was addressed in the Elegant Universe video when they talked about the colliding brains and things like that. So it's kind of interesting that...
That's why they're kind of shunned, is because it's not testable, right?
Well, that's the criticism of string theory in general. But the fact that respectable scientists are even asking those questions is what I find intriguing, whereas before we were told you can't even ask them in a scientific setting. Well, sweet. It's been fun.